Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products. Because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Car Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm your host, Scott Benjamin.
And I am another host, Kurt Guerin. And we have a third arm in the room, and that is...
That's true. My name is Ben Bolin. I am a Coco host here, I believe. And this is part two of our two-part series on the Iditarod, the race, not the trail. If you're just tuning in now, do yourself a favor, hit pause, we'll wait, and listen to part one of the series, wherein we dive into some of the history, a little bit of the nuts and bolts about the race, and then, only then, push play on this one, because now the rubber's hitting the road, or I should say the rails are hitting the snow, right?
Mm-hmm. Very clever.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Stayed up pretty late working on that one, so I'm glad you guys you guys are into that. Today we're going to dig into I would say some of the science behind the equipment, a little bit more about the race itself, and of course the lovable, hardworking dogs that make the entire thing possible. The race itself, when last we left, Scott, you were telling Kurt and I about the two different routes, and we were talking about why these might change or alternate from one year to the next. Let's pick up there, because there are checkpoints for the routes. That's how the race works. Mm-hmm. Every team has to hit certain points along the trail. There are 26 checkpoints on the northern route, 27 on the southern route. And when people hit those checkpoints, the mushers have to sign in. They have to throw their John Hancock on something. This has a couple of different functions, if we're guessing. One would be, of course, safety. Make sure that no one disappeared or something bad happened.
Sure.
And two, of course, to prevent cheating, to make sure that no one just tried to hot rod around, you know, and somehow take a shortcut.
And they have to sign in with their dog, like the dog team. Mm-hmm. They've got, you know, pulling the sled at that moment, because they do begin to drop dogs as we go through this race. So they start mm-hmm. out the race maybe with 12 dogs, mm-hmm. and then they drop down to 11 dogs, and then 10, and then 9. And then eventually, by the time they get to the finish, they might be down to as few as, what, 6, 7, 8 dogs maybe.
Yeah. And I think, you know, 5 have to finish. Is that correct?
Might be
5
right.
Have to cross the line.
Five cross the line, you're right. And these dogs are all, of course, well, we could talk about the care of dogs too, but the dogs are, when I say dropped, I mean that they're, you know, either carried back and handed off to a handler that, you know, travels along with the race alongside of the team. Mm-hmm. Not during the race itself, obviously, but they go from town to town in a much more efficient way and meet mm-hmm. them there, or they have them in place ahead of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a dog that's worn out or injured or, you know, whatever the case may be. It just needs a break, a rest.
Sometimes they'll ride along in the sled.
Yeah, they ride in the sled. Yeah, that's right. That's part of the benefit of some of the different sled designs, is that they can carry dogs that are somehow in need of that to the next checkpoint and safely deliver them.
Yeah, a good musher is like a combination cartographer, sledder, dog trainer, veterinarian, right? EMT at some points, you know.
Oh, yeah. They wear many hats.
And they have, I think this is important. They have drop bags that they pick up at checkpoints, and those drop bags have supplies that they use, right, to replenish their stores of food. But there's also a lot of stuff for the dogs involved.
Yeah, that's part of the equipment, right? Oh, that's another thing that I learned at that camp. We talked to a guy that was the guy that was kind of running our dog sled, that, you know, the wheeled one that we were talking about.
Uh-huh.
This is a long time ago. I think and the name that popped in my head immediately was Mars. And I thought, okay, who's Mars?
All right.
There is a musher on the Iditarod named Wade Mars, and his career span is just about the right time for when this was. So I'm assuming that the person that I met and talked to was Wade Mars.
Cool.
I'm sure that it was Wade Mars, because it just popped into my head right when we were talking about this. But one thing that he told me that just stood in my head for a long time, in fact, I'm still thinking about it, the dog booties, the booties that the dogs wear on, on their feet. And you think, oh, that's kind of funny. That's kind of very Hollywood, right? You know, they're wearing little dog shoes around. You know, it looks like something a little poodle would wear on, Rodeo Avenue when they're shopping. Right? It's,
right.
It's not that way at all. These are to prevent, injuries from ice and rocks and, you know, things like that they might encounter on the trail, or abrasions. It's these little sacks almost that they put on, and they're held on with, is it leather or Velcro or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like little socks they put on every dog's foot. And of course they throw these off while they're racing, while they're running. So these guys will go through, the mushers will spend a significant amount of money on dog booties every year in the training camp, in, you know, the race itself and other races, you know, qualifying races or whatever, you know, because the Iditarod is not the only race they're going to be in
for sure.
Dog race for the year. That's just not the way it works. But they will go through, they buy thousands of dog booties every year for every team, which I thought was incredible. Thousands of dog booties every year. That's got to be a huge expense.
Yeah, because think about it. You can't, if you want them to be comfortable, you can't just give them those dog booties during the race. They have to wear these weird paw shoes during training as well, so that it becomes a normal, customary thing for the animals.
Sure, and you know, the supplies that you were talking about that are shipped to each checkpoint.
Yeah,
there's limits on this, but I think, and I'm pretty sure that I read this in the rule book. I can verify this in just a little bit when we get to this, but.
Yeah.
I think it was like 60 pounds per package is what they send. And that's like, that's dog food. That's everything that they need. The musher needs, of course, because they got to carry everything with them. They have to be self-sufficient. The dogs eat a tremendous amount of food, and it's this really high energy. I don't know what they put in it to make it so high energy. I'm sure it's a lot of protein, probably a lot of fat, if I had to guess, because they're going to be burning so much energy. But a lot of this is dog food. Now imagine that you've got to ship 60 pounds of supplies to 26 or 27 different checkpoints. That right there is a pretty huge logistical nightmare.
Yeah. And gets expensive quickly, too,
yeah,
right?
That is a lot of... That's like 1,200 pounds of stuff that you got to get ready ahead of time and know where you're going to need it and make sure it's there.
Yeah, and they're already carrying gear with them that stays with them the entire time, like headlamps for night travel, tools and parts to repair a sled. Can you imagine how terrible it is if the wrong screw comes loose?
Yep.
Batteries, of course, for the lamps. And you know, nowadays people are carrying radios with them. You know, maybe they're listening to their favorite podcast.
Yeah, they probably. Hey, maybe they are.
Maybe they are. The interesting thing is, this reminded me a little bit about some of the restrictions placed on long-haul truckers. Every team has three mandatory rests they have to take during the Iditarod. And this is in the rules.
It is, yes. Yeah, they have to take there's a 12-hour layover and then there's a 24-hour layover. Is that right?
Well, there's a 24-hour layover that they can take at any point, at any checkpoint.
So it's a strategy game.
Yeah.
They decide when the dogs need it, when they need it, what the weather is doing, all that. That plays into when they take that 24-hour break.
Right. And then they have two mandated 8-hour layovers they have to take. One is at any checkpoint along the Yukon River. And then the one that never they can never move is the 8-hour stop at White Mountain.
Okay.
So I think you make a fantastic point there, Scott. with the flexibility of those two other places, there are ample opportunities to give yourself that last burst of energy, to recover from a particularly arduous leg. But there are also opportunities to fall behind, because mm-hmm. what if you are in the lead? You know what I mean? And I don't know whether this has ever happened. And you're like two checkpoints away, but you haven't burned your 24-hour layover yet. And you have to sit yeah. there. I don't know if this happened, but can you imagine? Like, you have to sit there for some reason, and you're watching the former number two and the former number three neck and neck, and you're thinking, maybe I should ask them to pause for like 12 hours. You know?
Yeah, you don't have like that pause button for them, right? I mean, it's only right. on your own account. And, you know, I think I said 12-hour layover. I'm mistaken. You're right. It was 8 hours. But, yeah, that's got to be frustrating to have to take that time, that downtime for some of them. Others might wish it was more. And I think others do take more. It's all up to you. It's just how quickly do you want to finish this? And this is a race of days. And, you know, it's not like a race of, you know, hours and minutes. It's a very long drawn out process, right? Where you have to play yeah. the long game. I mean, the long game, we're talking more than a week. It's a long journey from Anchorage to Nome. And they have to kind of account for the unforeseen, maybe. That's,
sure.
that's the way they have to do it. So if you take that break early on, what happens if there's a blizzard, you know, up ahead that you don't know about or you're not aware of that it's on its way, that, you know, suddenly cuts your visibility to zero and, you know, the temperature is 80 below zero.
Yeah.
That's Fahrenheit. That's not Celsius. Well, I guess it would be worse than Celsius, right? maybe it's not that bad then, right? 80 below Fahrenheit. That's if it's 80 below Celsius, look out. That's
yeah.
That's like you're on Neptune or something. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, that's a really important point, though, that people, there are three mandatory minimum layover times,
sure.
but anything can happen. So people end up taking extra time.
This is like pit strategy in racing, right? Or
yeah.
refueling strategy or any,
yeah.
every race has its own strategy and how people like to run it. Even like horse racing or something like that, you know, like do you hold back and then give it the all out there at the end of the last stretch, or do you just consistently go, or, you know, how do you do it? How do you play it? Do you sandbag and then go for it at the end? Or just go for it right out of the gate. I mean, it all depends on the horse. I guess it depends on your team, your dog team,
yeah.
and your ability. You know, you know how much you can take. And again, this is a true test of human endurance as well. Not many people are fit for a trip like this, really, when you
yeah.
think about it. I mean, I get cold walking to my car right now. It's mid-30s here in Atlanta. And I don't know. I guess I've become kind of a weather wimp, you know? Like, it's cold.
Oh,
it's colder
man.
At night. You know, it gets down to the 20s.
Yeah.
I don't want to take the dog out to go to the bathroom out in the backyard or something. You know,
need a sled.
It's uncomfortable. I don't want to be uncomfortable anymore, you know? And look at them. Really, blizzards,
yeah.
80. They I think they've recorded temperatures as low as 100 below zero. And that's wind chill, of course.
Right.
Wind chill. But have you ever felt like 40 below zero, you know, wind chill, it's awful. Like, they tell you not to expose your skin to it. They tell you that you can't go outside. I mean,
are you not supposed to breathe when it's that low?
It's 40 below is cold enough. We've talked about, I grew up in the Midwest, and like, I remember my dad going out to his older cars that had, you know, vinyl seats, and you sit in them and they crack all to hell. It's like you broke a chocolate bar that's been in there for a freezer or something, you know? It's like that. I mean, it's that brittle. So can you imagine what 100 below feels like? And they really do race through that.
Hmm.
It's insane.
Oh, it feels like, you know what, I would do it to say that I had that experience.
Yeah, but what if it kills you?
Well, then I won't get to say that I had that experience.
They'll say, well, Ben had one-third of that experience.
And that's how it ended for him.
Yeah, we would be left to spread the word of Ben.
Oh, thanks, guys.
I thought you were going to say his ashes on the trail.
Yeah. Wow, this escalated pretty quickly, guys.
Took a turn.
But let's stay with the trail. Let's let's talk a little bit about this, because we know that it can be dangerous. There have been canine deaths, especially. So a lot of the rules are focused on safety. Those layovers are not just to make things interesting, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This is, I believe, as we said at the top of part one, this is an incredibly brutal experience, right?
Definitely. It's a race of endurance. There's a lot of factors that go into being a top performer versus being just one of the people that are there to finish.
This race, we keep saying a test of endurance or physical challenge or, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. however you want to label that. Mm-hmm. The Iditarod will routinely come up on lists of the ultimate tests of human endurance, of how much can a human stand, whether it's heat, cold, time, you know, whatever the case may be. And there's a lot of absurd world records that people have set that are tests of endurance, and I don't think we have a chance to go into all those, but the test that people routinely do year after year, those are the ones that I find probably the most interesting. And Iditarod happens to come up on every list that I've looked at so far, and a couple of them, just so you get an idea of what is on these lists, there's the Race Across America, which is a bicycle ride that goes across mm-hmm. the United States, all the way across, all 3,000 miles. And it's essentially like a one-leg bicycle race. It's just this intense ride across the United States as fast as you can go. People do it in something like, I think the maximum you can do it is in 12 days. The person who has done it the fastest was like 7 days. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine riding your bike in 7 days from coast to coast in the United States? And we're talking, you know, again, over 3,000 miles in that time. That was back in 2014. There's the wow. Marathon des Sables, which is happening, or Sable, I don't know, Sable, in Morocco. And that's the one that you have to be entirely self-sufficient. It's an ultra-marathon. And the first race was held in 1986, and it's essentially a race across hot sands. I mean, intensely hot sands. You're racing across the desert.
Yeah.
And that's that. You know, these are... really, really dangerous. There's Ramsey's Round in Scotland. There's the Iditarod Trail, which we've been talking about all day. You can find out the details on that. There's something called the Jungle Marathon that happens in Brazil, which I think is really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
One thing that, okay, this is the last thing I'll mention about this endurance thing, but maybe for now. The one point that they pointed out in this National Geographic article that I was reading, it says the winner of the 2015 race is named Thomas Wittig of Germany, was stung by a stingray before the race even started. And then he went on to win in 40 hours and 10 minutes. This is a race that is run at 40 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that temperature is, but it's hot. It's the jungle. 99% humidity. It's a 158-mile course that goes through, swamps and rivers and steep descents, trails, beaches, climbs. It's just crazy. Like 25% of the people drop out ever before reaching the end just because of exhaustion.
Did you say 40 degrees Celsius?
40 degrees Celsius.
That's 104 degrees
so
Fahrenheit.
They're running a what essentially is an ultra marathon, I guess, in 158 miles through the jungle in
Jeez.
Brazil. With, they say anacondas, mm-hmm. they've got piranhas in the rivers, there are jaguars in the trees.
Different kind of miserable.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the winner that year in 2015 got stung by a stingray before the race and still won. I mean, that's nuts. So, these tests of endurance, like, they're not for the faint of heart. And the Iditarod is something that just when you ponder what that takes in your head to take off from that start line and know that your destination is 1,000 miles away through that territory, it's pretty shocking.
Most people who perform well in the Iditarod are from northern states in the United States or Arctic states.
Go figure.
Over in Europe. Yeah, so I mean, you have to kind of be acclimated.
Scandinavian.
For it.
Yeah. Are we going to have like a Cool Runnings kind of moment? You know.
Oh yeah. Yeah, the Jamaican team is going to show up there in Alaska maybe not win, but just have fun doing it.
I think anybody
from the
Southern
State. Do they have a car stuff relay team go up there and do it?
Yeah.
Do they have relay teams in the Iditarod?
No.
No, no, no. Single, no. You have to be a single?
It has to be a single musher, and the team is already signed up ahead of time. And the team, that's another thing. The dogs are all chipped, and of course, there's careful veterinary care along the way. You know, beforehand, there's all the vaccinations. There's everything that they need to have for them medically is done ahead of time and during the race and then after as well, the aftercare.
I'm sure when they make their stops, they monitor the dogs during those stops.
The chipping is important because that shows that you're not swapping out dogs that weren't there at the beginning. You know exactly who's who when they get
to, 'cause
it's tough to say, like, well, of course that's my dog Milky Way there.
You know that's happened before, and that's why.
Or whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's another funny. Look at the listed names of the dogs on the teams. They're all pretty funny. But imagine you've got to name, 12 dogs a couple times a year. You got litters of dogs that you then select your best team from, in training camps. And so when I was there, they were naming dogs like by groupings. Like they'd name them like fashion names or, like it'd be like Nike and Adidas and, the names. Like they kind of run out of names. They can't name them like here's, Ben, Scott, and Kurt. They do, but you'll run out. So they were naming them like candy bar names, and they come down to like star names or whatever, it's like grouping. So it's easier to remember them all. Mm-hmm. But imagine, you have to name like 36 dogs a year. That's hard.
I used to volunteer at this animal shelter. And the one thing that irked me about it, and it was a great place, support your local animal shelter. The one thing that irked me about it was that someone had this prestigious job where they would name animals. And they were just terrible at it. And it's a person who had been working there for years. So I was trying to be fair. And I was thinking, maybe at some point this person just ran out of names. It's like, I don't think this cat's name should be Umbrella, but look, I just volunteer here. You know what I mean? I think that's going to come back to haunt the cat, whatever. But cats don't care what their names are.
They were doing the Kaiser Soze thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Kobayashi. Yeah.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 40% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Let's talk about the dogs a little bit more, and then let's talk about the actual sled. Sound
sure.
good?
Yeah, of course.
All right, so there are several types of dog breed that are used. Purebreds are common in the most northern reaches of the hemisphere, Samoyed, Siberian Huskies, and so on, and Alaskan Malamutes would be another one. But most racing sled dogs are a mixed breed called Alaskan Huskies.
Hmm.
They're about 10, the breed's like 10,000 years old or so, according to Iditarod sources. It's not an officially recognized breed, but they're known for a couple of things. They're known for having very tough feet. They're also known for having a good weatherproof coat. And they're known for just loving pulling sleds.
Yeah, as I've seen, I've witnessed it.
And it's weird because, you know, for a lot of people who criticize the practice of dog sledding, you know, like PETA and folks of that nature, and even people who are unfamiliar with working breeds of dogs, it may seem incredibly cruel, but it is also a natural inclination. It's kind of like, have you guys ever seen herding competitions with working breed dogs?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's really weird because their natural inclination seems like such a specific behavior. Any living creature's natural inclination to be finding a herd of sheep or something and then just like not attacking them, just walk, making them go weird places. That's to me, that's weirdly specific. That's also something that these sorts of breeds seem acclimated to doing.
Have you ever been around a dog that is a herding dog that is not anywhere, like anywhere near a farm?
Yes.
That it was born a herding dog, but born like maybe in the city somewhere.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you, you know, you take it out to the park or whatever, and that dog will show herding characteristics or herding traits.
Like try to herd kids.
Yes, it will. They really will. I mean, I've seen it with my my brother-in-law's dogs, and they do this, and they have never, ever herded sheep, as far as I know, or cattle, or, you know, whatever they herd.
They just want people to move together.
They do. They want. It's like they want order, and they're going to make it happen, you know? That's what. And it's these little dogs, and it's like, what are you doing? You're trying to force me to go the way that you want me to go, but they do.
Yeah,
it's completely instinctual in these dogs, and they do get excited about it. Like you said, it's not what people think. I mean, I guess I had my own preconceived ideas that, you know, this is a little bit mean to make these, like, these dogs aren't going to pull seven people on these sleds or even one person for 1,000 miles on the sled. They're not going to like that. But when you see the excitement and the energy that they have, they're just jumping all over each other to pull that sled. They want to go. They want to run. Mm-hmm. And they really do. And if you don't buy my version of this, go online to any of these training camp sites where people have gone and had the same experience and read the comments. They'll say how excited and just pumped up these dogs are about running and how much they love doing what they do. They really enjoy it. And it's such a foreign idea to us because we think, oh, that's mean making them pull people around and, you know, these toys. It's not a toy to them. It's something that's bred into them, and they love it.
Well, this is a race, but we have to remember this race only exists because dog sledding was the primary means of transportation for a lot of people. So if people object to the race, that's totally within their right to do so, but even abolishing this particular race would not abolish the practice of dog sledding because for some people, even today, it's a better means of transportation, right? And with these dogs also, depending on what side you see about this, it's no secret that the endurance test, which is punishing to human beings, to the mushers, is also punishing to the canines. So yes, over the years, I think as recently as a few years back, five dogs had died in the course of this. And those kind of deaths are, you know, some of those things that can't be predicted very well. Diet, as you mentioned, is huge. These mushers are dedicating a lot of time to taking care of their dogs. So they even that high energy density food they get, they supplement it with, they add water, meat, fat, vitamins, even digestive enzymes to, I guess, take the inner work of digesting, smooth it out a little bit.
It's less work that their body has to do, and they could focus more energy on running, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more I read about these dog teams, the more you guys know I love comic books and comic book movies. My girlfriend says it's because I have terrible taste, but whatever. whatever. As I was reading about the composition, the position, and the roles of the different dogs, I felt more and more like I was watching one of those films where there's a heist crew getting together in the movies, and then it's like, oh, it's, you know, that's Slippery Jimmy, he's the safecracker, and Scumbag Pete, he drives the getaway.
They got their own specialty.
Yeah, they all have their specialties, right?
Yeah.
And the dogs are like this too. There are the lead dogs, because you'll notice when you see the dogs do have certain roles. The lead dogs understand these different commands that the mushers make, and they respond. And I think we had talked a little bit about some of those commands off air.
You mean like G and haw?
Yeah.
Haw means left turn. And G, is that how it said?
You know, I got to be honest, man. If I'm on the sled and we have to take that right turn, I'm just going to start yelling.
Well, we'll just ask the dogs.
Right.
And the lead dogs will be like, this Scott guy's an amateur.
I thought they just like crack the whip and yell mush.
Right.
That's what I see in every cartoon. And I mean, that's you know, well, I've seen it on many documentaries, I guess. There's this one documentary, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Oh, yeah.
There's a prospector who has a team, mm-hmm. and Cornelius, I believe, is his name.
There's that.
You don't remember that? That doc that they did? It was like the
claymation
one, right? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's a documentary.
Yeah.
And he would flip his, pickaxe in the air and then pick it up and, like, he'd kind of lick the end of it and decide if there was gold or silver there. Remember that?
Yeah.
He's a good guy.
Those claymation features from, the 50s through the 70s, some of them are pretty intense. Even watching them again as a kid, I thought, my parents were letting me watch this when I was like three.
I love it. You've gone soft, Ben.
I've gone soft. Yeah. I need to take an Iditarod trip.
Toughen up.
Get back to 100%. It's weird because some of these dogs also are considered not the lead dog. And I didn't think about this. For some reason, I always pictured the dogs being like raised together and trained together, but some of them are at different levels of experience and familiarity. So dogs that don't understand the directions, they're just like, who is this Kurt Guerin guy yelling G at me? those dogs, you would think, are put toward the back, right? But not really. Some dogs have not learned these commands, but they're still used as the lead dog because they're especially good at discerning trails, even when it's blown over with snow. Because the good folks at the Iditarod are pretty transparent. They say, we will go and break the trail beforehand, but due to weather, we can't guarantee basically that you're going to be able to see the trail itself.
Sure.
We'll try to put up markers. It's on you. So there are dogs that specialize just in finding that trail. And directly behind the lead dogs are the point or swing dogs. They're essentially backup leaders, second in command. Like if the lead dog is Captain Picard in Star Trek, then these are the Lieutenant Rikers. Does that work?
You've lost me.
I've lost you.
Yeah.
I was attempting a Star Trek reference.
Oh man, I'm out with Star Trek. I'm not a Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
Never have been. I never claimed to be. I think on the show we've talked about that. Maybe, or maybe it was with Jonathan over on Tech Stuff.
Yeah,
it sounds like more of a conversation he and I would have. But are you a big Star Trek fan?
I mean, I like the idea, but I'm not gonna go. I guess so. As much of a fan of other stuff. What about you, Kurt?
Mm-mm. I never got into.
I just thought of something. We're talking space, the final frontier, right?
Yeah.
Alaska, the last frontier, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it? Last frontier? Did they refer to it as the last frontier?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, there you go. That's a tie-in. There you go.
There we go.
We made it all up.
We made it. So
circle.
Sort of.
So we're on the sled, right? Right in front of the sled. The dogs directly in front of it are called the wheel dogs. Traditionally, these were the dogs that were on the larger side. The average weight of a dog, or most of them, is going to be between 45 and 50 pounds. The wheel dogs are going to be on the bigger end because they help provide that initial power.
They're bigger dogs?
Yeah.
Would you say they're a little husky?
Oh, man. I have no regrets. That was excellent. That was the best one.
Just came to me. I don't know. I was reading the tag on my jeans. Husky.
It's weird because off mic, Scott made Kurt and I be quiet for a second, and we just sat here awkwardly in silence for 8 minutes that hopefully got cut. It was Scott ran and got his post-it note with that joke on it.
I just all relied on you saying bigger dogs, that's all.
Yeah.
Talking about the fat dogs.
I should have got there earlier. But yeah, so we've got the dogs. What about the, just real quick, what do we know about the sleds?
The sleds are relatively fascinating. Your modern lightweight racing sled generally weighs about 20 to 30 pounds. That's 9 to 13.5 kilograms. And most sleds are made of ash lashed together with leather or nylon, though there's a trend to start to make the sleds out of more composite materials, which I'm surprised that that hasn't taken effect sooner.
I bet it's much more common in competitive sledding, mm-hmm. competitive events, you know what I mean?
Like, I mean, that's a traditional sled that we're talking about, right? The ash wood that's lashed together. I think it's the one we can all picture, too, is the, you know, the typical wooden sled. And, geez, I mean, to be honest, a 20 to 30-pound sled, that's not bad. These are big items. They're not small. They have to carry all the gear that, you know, we've talked about. And there's a couple of different types, too. There's the toboggan style. I think most people can picture a toboggan with kind of the open design, I suppose. That's the best way to say it. And then there's the other type that's the basket style. And that's one that has more of a nose cone look to it, like a nose cone of a plane or something.
I see. Okay, yeah.
And that one, to me, that makes the most sense for this type of race, because I've read that, you know, in really, really bad weather, or maybe not even in just normal weather there in Alaska, the musher can then take their sleeping bag and tuck that inside the basket and sleep in there and use it as a tent almost. Hmm. So that's where they sleep. The dogs, of course, have their own, you know, natural protection against weather and the elements like that. But and they do carry straw and things like that for them to bed down on at night for the dogs. But a couple of different designs are possible. And, you know, we've seen other designs of sleds, too. I mean, there's the real, real simple ones that look like, you know, the old style stadium chairs that look like folding chairs almost. They're wooden. Very, very simple design, very very small. Look like matchsticks almost, you know, that they built this chair out of. There's that kind. I think, I can't remember the name of it now, but it's a very small sled, very short. It's just two skis and a seat in front, basically.
Uh-huh.
And the musher will stand behind the chair with their hands on top of it, and that's where they guide it from. But lots of different types of these dog sleds are possible, but these racers have to have some common safety features too, right?
Yeah.
So one that I saw at this this camp was the emergency brake, which surprised me, right? Because the dogs will take off on their own and pull the sled to the next location. They've got some kind of, you know, I said they love to run.
Yeah.
They'll take off without a musher and go the full distance. They'll go to the next town unless they're caught without the musher. And that's happened before where, you know, they have to send out a team, you know, on snowmobiles or snow machines to go out and rescue the sled, I guess, from the dog team as they're running away.
Right. And this foot brake that they have, think of it like a series of claws, foot-activated claws. They also have a pronged metal claw, which is called a snow hook, that can temporarily keep the team stationary.
That's the emergency brake, the hook. And the hook looks like something you'd catch a whale on or something.
Oh, yeah.
It's this massive dual claw thing that when the dogs pull, they actually pull it deeper into the snow or the ground or whatever it's in. It's very effective, but it looks like this massive, massive hook thing that has to hold back the entire team of dogs. The one that you're talking about is it's called a drag mat, and I thought this was very clever of them. If you can picture a piece of conveyor belt that is flipped upside down with, like, you know, the ridges for the conveyor belt, the rubber conveyor belt maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, you know, 2 feet wide, whatever it happens to be, the span of the skis hangs down in between the driver's feet as they're riding. They can, you know, raise it and lower it if they want to. But all they have to do is then kind of step on the mat to kind of feather the speed, because the dogs are going so fast, you have to slow them down and not necessarily stop them every time.
Because you could hurt them if you stop abruptly or attempt to.
Or if they're trying to take a mountain pass and the dogs are pulling too fast and, you know, think they're going to go over the edge.
Or going downhill too, I would imagine the sled picks up quite a bit of speed.
Oh,
you
would
run up on, you know, you want to keep the tension right.
Oh, very good point. Yeah. And they said that, you know, you can even drive, you know, nuts and bolts through that mat to add kind of some biting strength to it.
Yeah.
There are other types of brakes that can be used, but they are not necessarily favored on these types of sleds, because a lot of the racers will race in the same path as the person in front of them.
Right.
You know, it's like a worn path. And if you use a different type of brake that operates where the rails are, where the skis are, it will leave deep ruts then that the next rider will have to deal with, you know, where the sled will bottom out, or it will, you know, lurch to one side or the other, depending on where the brake was. So these drag mats seem to be the key in the whole thing. Pretty smart. Smart design.
Pretty smart. And there's another thing when we talk about design. It's not just the design of the sled itself. We should also talk about the design of the race, which, yes, I do mean to refer to the rule book that you mentioned, Scott.
Yeah.
She read the whole thing. I looked at it. I didn't.
That's all right.
I read some parts more closely than others.
How about you, Kurt? Did you read any of the rules at all?
I haven't read the rules.
Okay, so I don't know why I found this interesting. I thought I was going to be bored to death with the whole thing, right? Because it's 15 pages of rules about a dog sled race. And I'm not a dog sled racer. I'm not a musher. I don't have much to do with it other than we were doing this podcast.
You're also not a rules guy. Scott, the rules Benjamin.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Me and Smokey Eunuch. So anyways, I started to look at the rules, and I got more and more into these rules because there's some really obscure, odd rules in here.
Some very strict ones, too.
They're very strict. And, of course, they're all serious. They're all, and some of these rules are just so out there compared to different races and things that we're more accustomed to around here, you know, in other races and other parts of our life. But just real briefly, I mean, the rules are 15 pages long, and you can search this online if you want to look at them for yourself. They're amusing and interesting and, you know, informative and all that. It's worth, you know, 10 minutes of time just to scan them, if nothing else. Just search for Iditarod Rules 2020, and it'll come up with the full final list. Rules, just to give you an example, like a lot of them are about the mushers themselves. A lot of them are about the equipment, the sleds themselves. There's a whole group of rules just about the treatment of dogs, and those are like rules number 38 through 48, and they're 37 through 48, and they're all kind of clustered that way, right? And, I mean, these include things like, you know, the dog care and the food shipping and all that and the amounts and, you know, the requirements for shots and all that stuff. Very important rules about the dogs, of course, and the mushers and, you know, what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do, even littering and things like that on the trail. There were some really fascinating ones, and I chuckle about a couple of these, but you really shouldn't. I mean, some of them are again, dead serious, and there's reasons behind this. But one of the funny ones I came across initially was rule number 34. So if you look at rule number 34, it's about the killing of edible game in that it's necessary in order to protect your life or your equipment or your team or, you know, whatever that happens to be, your life or your property, I guess, in defense of that. And it has happened on the trail before. The fact is that when this race is run in March of every year, there's a lot of snow up there. And, of course, there's a lot of snow. And that will often force the moose out onto the trails, which are less wooded. And it's easier for them to get around, to forage and to, you know, just to get to point A to point B for the moose. However, you come around a corner and there's a mad moose in front of you. They start charging your dog team, which they do. They get angry. There have been times in the past. In fact, I think the first woman the second woman to win the race in 1985,
mm-hmm.
missed the win in the previous year only because a pregnant moose was around one of the corners as she came around, and it charged her team, killed two of her dogs. Mm-hmm. The moose did, injured another one. And another rider eventually came upon them. This is like 20 minutes later, came upon them and shot and killed the moose. Then there's a rule in here, this rule number 34, about what you have to do once you kill the moose.
This is interesting. Let's walk through this. Rule 34, not the famous internet rule 34, which we won't mention because this is a family show. Rule 34 for the Iditarod is the following, killing game animals. In the event that an edible big game animal, i.e. moose, caribou, buffalo, is killed in defense of life or property, the musher must gut the animal and report the incident to a race official at the next checkpoint. Following teams must help gut the animal when possible. No teams may pass until the animal has been gutted and the musher killing the animal has proceeded. Any other animal killed in defense of life or property must be reported to a race official but need not be gutted.
Interesting, huh? Mm. Now, what other race have you heard where that is one of the rules?
Not NASCAR, that's right, for sure.
You know what? It's probably going to be in there in 2020. someone will bend that rule this year, right?
Yeah.
So, no, really, that's an odd rule, right? I mean, so I read that, and I thought, well, there's got to be more in there. There's got to be other things like that. But the reason that they do that, and if anybody out there is confused, it's because it's edible meat. And so that, you know, the nearest town or the nearest community will be able to come out, you know, via radio, know where it is and on the course, come out, pick up that, you know, that now gutted,
oh, cool.
ready for butchering animal,
yeah.
and be able to provide to the community. They'll give it to those in need, you know, those who need it. And
that's
whether
really
that's
awesome.
Sharing it among, you know, the townsfolk, or, you know, and they know of a family that needs meat for the season or whatever. That's what the reason is behind that. So, you know, if it's another type of animal that, you know, is not a game animal, not one that people eat,
right,
and you still have to do that, the gutting rule, I guess, doesn't apply to that animal. It just, you know, the caribou, the moose, and what was the other one, elk or whatever it was. But I thought that was an interesting rule. And there's several others that are similar interesting items, maybe not quite as obscure as that one might be, but
or quite as specific.
Yeah, maybe. Rule number 16 is a mandatory items list that the mushers must carry.
Yeah, I saw that.
And that's important. I mean, everybody has common sense, you know, about what they need to wear, you know, the number of layers, the type of jacket or gloves or whatever. But this one has mandatory items that you have to carry in order to be cleared for you know, for competition.
Some of it's basic and some of it's pretty impressive. So, of course, a sleeping bag, duh.
Yeah, but with a minimum weight, right?
Right. Minimum must weigh 5 pounds minimum. And an axe, snowshoes, specific dimensions for those.
Yep.
Any promotional material provided by the race organization, 8 booties for each dog in the sled or in use. So that's total.
Yeah.
So they need at least 4 that they're wearing at all times and a backup.
So you got 12 dogs. You need 8 booties for each dog. You can do the math, but that's a lot of booties to carry around initially. And then that number declines, of course, as you go through them and drop off dogs and things like that.
And then this was interesting. This impressed me. A veterinarian notebook. Because when you get to the veterinarian checkpoint, you have to have, it's essentially, you know, like if you're a responsible car owner, you keep a repair log and you have your mileage and you have the, you know, like your yearlies and all that stuff, your 30K or whatever. They kind of have that for the dogs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was responsible. And then they have to have dog coats. They've got several specific things here. I'll tell you. One thing that I was curious about that I didn't find out until I went to the rule book was, you know, I'm a cheapskate ever since we did this show. I'm still really a cheapskate. Like it's impairing my relationships. But I looked into how much it would cost to get going, right?
Yeah.
Not counting equipment, not counting dogs. Dogs are the biggest expense.
Yeah.
Equipment is the second, right? The entry fee alone is $4,000.
It's pretty expensive.
It's just, it's not a, I'm saying this because we need to establish this is not a thing where you can just like fly up a few weeks before March and say, you know, hey, how much is this sled going to run me?
Yeah.
At Target or something. you have to, that's $4,000 if you submit before December 2nd, 2019. After that, you have to pay an extra non-refundable fee, so it's $8,000.
$8,000 just
total.
To enter
you
the
have
race.
To pay an extra $4,000. Yeah, if you go late.
Yeah, and
it's a late fee.
Yeah, it's a late fee.
Yeah,
that's steep.
That is a steep late fee. And really, when you think about how much it takes to—I mean, a lot of these, you know, runners. Wade Mars, the guy that I was talking about, he runs his own kennel now. So he has, you know, the dogs on his property that he is kind of grooming for this whole thing. And, you know, of course, there's going to be, you know, speaking engagements that they can do and make a little money here and there. Last I heard, the payouts weren't terribly great compared to what you invest in order to run in this race because the sleds are expensive.
Right.
The equipment is expensive. We all know, I mean, try to buy a really nice jacket. Just as a simple example.
Just
a really
one
nice
jacket.
Just one jacket. Yeah, that's an expensive item, right? So you're going to buy that. You got to buy, you know, all of the gear that is Arctic gear, you know, stuff that's, I mean, we're talking really, really heavy duty camping gear for you know, the coldest temperature you've ever felt in your life.
Yeah.
And keep the dogs healthy, keep the equipment in operation, keep all, you know, make sure that you have all these things shipped. You run a team of people, you know, that are at different checkpoints to help you along the way and to pick up dogs and to transport dogs. And it's just the logistics of this race are mind-boggling. You know, when you think about what it takes to put it together, it's not something that, like Ben said, you can't go there a couple weeks ahead of time and expect to enter the race. This is something that you get ready for years in advance, plan for, train for, you have to qualify for.
Right.
You have to get another musher that is already, you know, a veteran musher to write a note of recommendation for you as somebody that they trust if you're a rookie. You know, that's part of the rules too.
You have to take a drug test 30 days before. Your dogs have to take a drug test
during the competition as well, at points when they decide, when they determine.
Yeah.
So no
random.
Brand,
you it's know, like random. Yeah, like any athlete.
Yes, yeah, so you're not going to have a chance, you know, to warm up with some brandy along the course there if you want to.
They're very strict about it.
Maybe you can have a tiny little bit of brandy, but that's about it. And they check the dogs as well. And it's completely random. They may say the first grouping of 15 mushers that enter this town, we're going to test all of them, you know, with a spit test, a urine test, a blood
sure.
test, a hair test, whatever it is. We're going to test the dogs, or they may just randomly select one person. They may, it's really as they see fit, I guess,
yeah.
when they do it. Okay, so that's where there's, oh man, that's another thing. You know, the drugging of dogs for added performance. That's mm-hmm. another rule, which is rule number, happens to be number 39, I believe.
Right, yeah.
The substances that you had talked about before, you know, no diuretics, no muscle relaxers for the dogs.
Nothing that can suppress signs of illness or injury.
They will, however, I thought this was interesting, let them use steroids on their paws. A certain type of steroids that are approved through the medical office there ahead of time, the veterinary office, for injured paws so that they heal quickly, because you know they do. They're taking a ton of abuse on that course. You know, the ice and snow and rocks
yeah.
and all that. You know, the debris that's there.
And the dogs are evaluated pretty thoroughly by a veterinarian.
Yeah.
Before entering the race, there's one other drug they're allowed to use for an estrus suppressant. It's called Ovaban is the, it's not super creative.
Well, it gets kind of specific, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I believe that drug is specifically meant to keep the dogs out of heat.
Oh,
so okay. they can stay focused on the race, on the mission.
Stay focused, dogs, stay focused.
So it's strange because like many other competitive sports or other races, they did have in the Iditarod a bit of a doping scandal in recent years because there were some dogs that tested positive.
Well, that's why they're pretty specific about it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and what's allowed. And if you look at the list, it does have the feeling to me that like every year that list probably grows a little bit. Like someone tries something new, you know what I mean? Like
right.
they detect something that is somehow an enhancement to that dog's energy level or the oxygen, you know, carrying capability of the blood level in that dog, you know, that type of thing.
It's just like you said, it's like NASCAR,
yeah.
the way that NASCAR changes every time. Also, one thing I love about really specific rules like this, anywhere you go, whether it's a department store, whether you're putting together furniture and looking at the instructions there, the weirdly specific stuff always tells a story between the lines. You know what I mean? Like even when you
yeah.
see those bizarre laws that are still on the books in different U.S. states.
Yeah.
It's like, imagine you're putting together a couch and it's like, all right, step four, attach the joist from point A to the, you know, to the, this part of point B. And then like the next step is like, under no circumstances attempt to entirely eat joists and digest them. If you do so, contact a medical professional immediately. Please note that the joist should no longer be considered usable. Please see Appendix A for full details. And you're like, who ate part of this couch?
you know what the equivalent of this is here in the office? Like,
what's that?
If suddenly an email comes out about something that you've just done. You know, like,
oh, yeah.
you burn something in the toaster. It's like, you know, and an hour later, the email comes out to everyone, you know, for
hello,
all future
all.
Users yeah. of the toaster, you know, that type of thing, you know. So, you know, exactly, there's one person that has screwed something up and caused that rule to be enacted.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
So, should we go electric?
I think we should go electrified with Toyota.
Electrified?
Electrified means options. Yes, we could go all electric with a Toyota bZ4X, but then there are hybrids like Grand Highlander. Or we could do something in between like a RAV4 plug-in hybrid.
So, Toyota is electrified diversified?
Yep, and with more options for reducing carbon emissions, the closer we all get to Toyota's Beyond Zero vision for the future.
Exactly how much coffee have you had this morning?
Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
Unfortunately, if you go down a couple of rules farther, down to 42,
yeah,
there's a rule about expired dogs, as we talked about before, and the treatment of those and what has to happen. And just so everybody's aware of this, when a dog does expire on the trail, which does happen, and for whatever reason, they determine the reason. They do a quick, I don't think they call it an autopsy. It's called like a necropsy, I think, or something like that.
Right.
They run that. They have, you know, veterinarians check it out. They do the blood samples and everything. The musher is held in the next checkpoint, you know, after the dog is delivered, you know, unfortunately deceased.
To figure out what happened.
To figure out exactly what happened, to find it, to determine if there is any abuse that was there or drug overdose or, you know, whatever happened to that dog. They find out the cause of death and either, you know, either pull that musher from the competition if there is something suspect in there, or they allow the musher to continue if it's deemed as, you know, a natural death. If something
an unpreventable hazard, an act of God, basically.
Well, yeah, it's a hazard of the race, and I mean, yeah. it does happen. It does happen. You know, someone will point to a human marathon and say that if we had deaths in this human marathon at the rate we have in the Iditarod, we'd have a big problem, right? If people were dropping in the Boston Marathon or the New York Marathon like they do in the Iditarod, and it's not like dogs are dying every year by any means. It's just it happens occasionally, and it seemed like for a couple of years there was a grouping where it happened often, but anyways, that's something you can investigate on your own. But there is a rule about expired dogs and about, you know, what has to happen there, unfortunately. It has to be there.
It has to be there, but also it's prefaced with the Iditarod holds firmly that no dog should suffer harm or death in connection to the race. And it's good that they have a process in place to make sure that there's not some unscrupulous musher out there.
Absolutely. But, you know, you talk to, you know, people that do this, and they love their dogs. I mean, they are... They're part of their family. I mean, it's
John Wick rules, man. Don't mess with people's dogs.
No, they really do. They love these animals. So, anyways, we'll move on past that. There's another couple that I want to mention here that I think were interesting. There are rules about passing, which I thought were interesting. That's rule number 26. Passing, there's some interesting right-of-way type situations that happen where, you know, if someone is approaching you from behind, you need to let them pass, and there's a certain amount of time you have to wait before you retake the trail and, you know, that type of thing. So there's passing rules, if you wonder how that works. So they're not getting next to each other and, you know, like trying to knock each other out of the way like Mad Max style or something. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, you know, that there's not somebody out there that's doing that, but do you think they would be reported in the next... the next checkpoint, of course.
Yeah, the way it works is if someone's coming up behind you, they can say, get out of the way, and you have to. You have to stop your team, and you have to hold the dogs for 60 seconds or until the other team is passed, whichever happens first. That's interesting, right? But the team that gets passed can't repeat that action until at least 15 minutes have expired.
So you got to stay behind the team that passed you for a minimum of 15 minutes.
And then get out of the way. Now then, you get out of the way.
Yeah. Well, you got that 60-second break, so you got all that energy, right? You can blast past them, right? I wonder if dogs don't have rearview mirrors. So I wonder if it's sort of a surprise when someone yells from behind you.
I don't know why.
Get out of the way.
That sounded so profound. That sounds like what you were talking about with the lead dog thing earlier. That sounds like something I would see on a bumper sticker. And it's like, dog sleds don't have rear view mirrors. I don't know.
It's not really a life lesson. It's just a fact.
But it sounds like it's about something
it
else.
It could be. You know, I'm going to work on that. There's got to be something that
Let's
ties
workshop
into that.
Yeah.
Okay. And the last one that I wanted to mention, the last rule, and of many, many rules in this book, is number 23. There's something called the Good Samaritan Rule. And the Good Samaritan Rule is pretty interesting to me. Ben, I don't have it in front of me right now due to a computer failure.
I'll read this one. Yeah.
Rule 23.
Rule number 23, the Good Samaritan Rule, states that a musher will not be penalized for aiding another musher in an emergency. Incidents must be explained to race officials at the next checkpoint.
I love this rule. You know, this goes back to you and I talking about how we would occasionally, and then I guess we've slipped out of this, but would help somebody, you know, with a flat tire.
Roadside? Oh, yeah.
A roadside assistance, you know, like of another citizen, how that's kind of gone away now. We don't necessarily do that anymore. Here and there, maybe yes, you know, in certain circumstances. But the Good Samaritan Rule ensures that, you know, someone's stuck out there in the wilderness with a broken dog sled ski, or, sure, you know, they're having a trouble of some kind, or, you know, a moose situation. Who knows? Mm. Whatever moose. It is, the Good Samaritan Rule comes into play that you have to aid the fellow contestants, the fellow mushers.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great rule to have. I mean, that, you know, you can't just ignore them and leave them out there, because in this case, you know, you ignore them, there's a good chance they might die out there.
The whole team could die.
Yeah, the whole team. I mean, it really could happen. There have been no human deaths that I know of to date from 1973 until present. A few dog deaths here and there,
right?
But no human deaths. And I think the Good Samaritan Rule probably has a lot to do with that.
Oh,
that,
sure.
You know, being, you know, just helping out your fellow man. It seems like that's just the right thing to do anyway. I think most people would do that regardless if there was rule number 23, if there wasn't.
So I guess the accumulated total time, kind of the time clock stops when you stop to help someone.
You won't be penalized. Yeah.
So before this rule, I mean, I would imagine that maybe the drive to...
Yeah, and I think
it
might come down to position, too. You know, the one coming to the aid is not penalized a position versus the other one. Because I think when they, you know, if they get back on the trail, maybe they determine how, you know, what the gap should be and that type of thing. So without knowing the specifics of every situation, you know, it's tough to say. But I think that they're just generally, which is nice to say, they're generally fair about things, which is good.
Well, yeah.
There's an etiquette to this, to the race.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And a bit of, you know, as I mean, they're women participate also, but it's kind of a gentleman's rule.
Well,
you know?
There's not any, there's chivalry to it, right? And there's not any, I would say most of the people racing, they're not there to become millionaires off of it. They're racing because they enjoy the journey and they enjoy the competition. And part of the competition is a really enjoyable competition has fairness.
Well, this is a generational thing too, right? I mean, well, if you look down the list of winners from 1973 till present, you're going to find that a lot of these, the winners of the Iditarod are either, you know, I think there's a father-son, there's a lot of brothers and even sisters that, you know, have raced and won.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
It's fascinating to look down the list of repeat winners and see who's won, you know, 3, 4, 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting, you know, and then there's always going to be the first, you know, like the first father-son, you know, years apart, obviously, or maybe the next year or whatever. But then, you know, the first person to win 2 in a row, the first person to win 3 in a row, you know, repeats, the first woman, the first whatever, you know, there's always first of everything.
This is one of those sports, you know, what's interesting to me about this type of racing is it's one of those competitions that probably will never have autonomous vehicles involved. There probably will not be
electric.
An electric sled race. There are, but it won't be the Iditarod, and there probably won't be, you know, a computer at the other end of the sled that's yelling its haws.
You know, before we finish this up, I want to point out that what did we say that the first race was won in? It was like 20 days, wasn't it?
20 days. That's right. Yes,
20 days and some odd hours, and we were gonna tell our listeners how that time has been cut down and cut down and cut down. And, of course, it's incremental, right?
20 days, 0 hours, 49 minutes, and 41 seconds.
Okay, so 20 days is how long that first competitor was out there and all the teams behind him. That was the fastest. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is out there a lot longer, right? Okay, so in 2017, I only have the numbers for for 2017. Actually, you know what? I shouldn't say I only have the numbers. I have the course record, which was broken in 2017. 2018 and 19 didn't produce
didn't
a record.
Didn't
break a record, but 2017, the winner was a guy named Mike Seavey. And that's the musher. And Mike Seavey, I think he's a repeat winner, too. He wasn't, this isn't his first win. Get this, Ben.
Yeah.
And Kurt, get this. 8 days, 3 hours, 40 minutes, and 13 seconds. So they have cut down from 20 days down to 8 days. And not even like 8.5 days, it's like just over 8 days. So that's unbelievable to me. I mean, how do you cut that much off of a winning time? In order to break the record, I mean that is a shattered record right there. But I know that over the last how many years is that now? It's 40 plus years, right? 46 years now that they've run this thing. It's gone down slowly. The course record is then 19 days, 18 days. It jumps down like that. But to get from 20 to 8, that's pretty remarkable, really. Something's up. I mean, is it better dogs? Is it better sleds? Is it better mushers? Is it faster snow?
Well, the weather had to be good. It was a southern route because it was an odd number year, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe the route has some sort of role. I don't know.
That's interesting.
Lighter sled. I would go ahead and say that.
Over the years, in the big picture, it's probably just the stature of the event and the way that people approached it probably just got more and more competitive as things
now
do.
See, I buy that too. I think that early on, I think that it was like we're all going to do this and it's going to be a good time, but no one is like training in the off season in order to lose weight in order to make their sled lighter, and no one is looking at alternative materials for their sled, and they're not feeding their dogs like super high energy food and the right types of medical drugs that they can give their dogs that help them to grow bigger and stronger and that are still legal for the dog race or dog sled race. But it seems like people get more and more competitive about things, and I think money is probably a bit of a driver because there is a bigger purse now than there ever was. It really wasn't a race about money to begin with.
Right.
Well, it's a lifestyle. It's an established sport.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people make their living doing this.
Sure.
These types of races. So.
Yeah.
I'm sure that plays into it.
I know that people start to take things more and more serious, but it's kind of like I see this, I guess a correlation of this is that, we talked about how hard it is to, you can't just show up and do this. Mm-hmm. There used to be there were some types of auto racing that you could do the same thing for, right? You can just show up and race and, you pay your entrance fee and you've got the same equipment as, the semi-pros do that are already there. Everything seems to go this way, seems to get this way that, then if you don't have, now you're at the point in a lot of series where if you don't have $2 million to start and eight cars, in the garage, you're not going to be able to do it. And it's, in a way, simpler for the dog sledders to compete, but it also takes more time and more preparation and more understanding of what it was all about and the history of in order to do this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like we could talk about this all day, really. I mean, how these different shades of gray, I guess, of why people do it and how they get better at it and I don't know.
It's because you can't ride moose. Let's be honest. Dogs are great.
That's right.
Would you want to see a moose race?
I would want to see a moose race. I really would.
I would.
Would you wear a saddle? Well, not you. I mean, the moose.
No, not me. No.
Would the moose wear a saddle?
That's the thing. Apparently, I zoned out for a little bit because I was thinking about this, and I just checked on it off mic, and apparently it's very difficult to ride moose.
Mm.
They don't care for it.
Yeah. They're pretty big.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're... They can be angry too, from what we've heard in this.
Did I tell you
discussion?
I went. One of the things I was doing when I was up in Alaska is I interviewed a
moose,
a lovely lady who, she's retired, she's elderly now, but even just a few years ago, she actually got in a one-on-one fight with a moose that was attacking her husband. Well, she had a dog there too. I was trying to chase the moose off, she had to grab a shovel from a pickup truck and just start wailing on it. And eventually, I think the thing is, the size difference was so big that eventually the moose just became inconvenienced and then decided to leave. You know
it's
what
just
I mean?
Bothered by her.
Yeah. It's just like, well, this is not what I signed up for.
Yeah, this is.
And we've all been there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's how I am with laundry. I get it.
I wonder what the moose is going after her husband for, though.
I don't know, but a mad moose is a very dangerous thing because, you know, occasionally when they perceive humans as threats, their initial, like any wild animal, their initial idea, if they think you're a threat, is going to be to either, is to flee.
Yeah.
But then the second option is to fight. So
moose are giant.
You know, they're huge.
I was camping in Killarney, Canada, and we were headed to go camping in Killarney, Canada.
Yeah.
And it was probably around 1990, early 1990s, maybe 1990 even. And we're headed up, and this is in like north of Michigan in Canada. And it's pitch black. It's night. We've been traveling all night, and we're in this minivan. It was in Ford Aerostar, so back then, you know.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We're driving this minivan, so we're up kind of high, and we're on a gravel road. No lights anywhere. It's pitch black. My friend Mark slams on the brakes, and we skid a pretty significant distance. We were going too fast, but we skidded a long way on this gravel. And there we are, eye to eye with a baby moose.
Oh, wow.
And it's big. I mean, it's like, it's 7 feet tall. You know, if it felt like it was 7 feet tall. It's probably 6 feet tall.
Right.
But it had, you know, the nice big wide body, you know, like the big fat belly and everything.
Barrel,
it's just what you would think, you know, like a baby, but it's clearly a baby, a young
one.
And
they look kind of gawkish. I don't know. They look awkward.
It's like the legs shouldn't hold them up. The body's really big and their head's big and, you know, all that. And it was an awkward looking animal, but it's very calm. And it just kind of stared at us for a few seconds and we were all catching our breath looking at it in the headlights.
Yeah.
And just walked away. Just strolled off to the side of the road. But we were lucky not to hit it because I think it would have done significant damage to the car.
Oh, yeah. Last moose story. This is just something I've heard. So Alaskan residents write to us and let us know if you've run into this before. I heard that people in Alaskan towns around Halloween have a problem with jack-o'-lanterns because the moose love to eat pumpkins. So you'll carve a pumpkin and put it out, and then some moose will come by and just sort of like lazily chaw on it, you know? And what are you going to do?
They like pumpkins.
How far are you willing to go to protect that?
Don't put too much time into the carving of that pumpkin, I guess, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, because you know what they say, guys? Dog sleds don't have rearview mirrors. No, it's not working. It feels like it's supposed to mean something else.
Maybe it'll work.
I don't know.
We'll figure it out.
But that's the Iditarod.
Yeah, there's a lot to it, isn't there? And there's probably a lot more than we're talking about.
Yeah, we just scratched the surface, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, we just pawed the snow.
Yeah.
But I am fascinated by it. You know, the three of us have been fans of the outdoors. Temperature dependent, right, Scott?
No, it's getting cold.
Yeah, and I for one would love to travel back up to Alaska maybe in March to just at least see the launch because they launch from Anchorage.
So. Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah,
how about the finish? I mean, they have we didn't talk about it, but listeners can check this on their own. But there's the Burled Arch that they cross underneath.
Oh yeah,
there's a whole history behind that, and that's a pretty fascinating story too. But we didn't have time.
Next time.
How's that for a tease, right? I mean, we don't have time. We just don't have time. But look up the Burled Arch with the Iditarod, and there's a story behind that, and the original arch that was destroyed, and now they've got a new one, and it's really cool. And maybe we can see that someday. Who knows? I mean, Alaska's not like, it's not impossible to get to anymore, right? Pretty easy.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Flights daily.
Unless something happened while we were in the studio.
No, flights daily. You can take a cruise there. You could drive there. Mm-hmm. I guess, well, Kurt, he's a bicycler. He could bike there, I'm sure, right? He's got endurance.
We want to hear from you. Are you someone who objects to the Iditarod because of maybe concerns about the animals? Are you someone who supports this competition? Are you someone who has participated in the Iditarod or any sled race? If so, we would love to hear from you. You can find Car Stuff on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. We're Car Stuff, all one word or some, you know, derivation thereof. You can also find every single episode that Scott, Kurt, and I have ever done on our website, carstuffshow.com. Even the first ones. Remember those first ones, Scott?
Those were ugly.
Oof, boy, yeah. I shouldn't have even said that on air.
Some might have said this one was ugly, but you know what? I think that we're getting better as time goes on. We're like a fine wine, Ben.
Yeah, you know, age like wine, not like milk.
Well, when we look back, you know, in our dog sled rearview mirrors,
we
find that you know, the early episodes were a little tough going. They were a little forced, but we got there, right?
Yeah, I think throughout our career with Car Stuff, you guys, we only have one episode that we were ever recording that we decided not to publish. You remember that one?
I do. I can't believe you're bringing that up right now.
Yeah, it's true though, and we'll never divulge what that is.
Yeah, I'll tell Kurt later. He doesn't know.
So let us know. We hope you enjoyed this episode. We hope you tune in for our future episodes. No spoilers, but we have a episode about spoilers. I'm kidding. No, we don't have an episode about spoilers yet. We have this huge treasure trove of topics we want to cover. So we also want to hear from you if you have suggestions for topics you feel that your fellow listeners would enjoy in the future.
And thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Car Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
That Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world. They just disagree on how.
We're going to get across that wasteland, and we're going to do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.